Greetings, friends. My name is Jessa McLean, and I'm here to provide you with some blueprints of disruption. This weekly podcast is dedicated to amplifying the work of activists, examining power structures, and sharing the success stories from the grassroots. Through these discussions, we hope to provide folks with the tools and the inspiration they need to start to dismantle capitalism, decolonize our spaces, and bring about the political revolution that we know we need.
Today, we are talking to Monica, an activist and surgeon who recently traveled to Gaza on a humanitarian mission. From the insane conditions placed at the border to the stories of the brave doctors in Gaza who have been working nonstop for over 2 years, this conversation was a stark reminder of the extent of the cruelty imposed on Palestinians by the Zionist entity. I wish I could say I was surprised to learn that although Monica has made themselves available to major media since returning, her story has been ignored. First-hand accounts like hers are too few and far in between, which makes it that much more important for us to welcome her onto our show today.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Doctor, introduce yourself to the audience, please.
Sure. My name is Monica. I'm a general surgeon. I work in Orillia, Ontario. And I recently went to Gaza to work as a surgeon. I was working with a group called Humanity Auxilium, which is a small humanitarian organization based in Canada and the U.S. I went as part of a WHO EMT team, and I was there for a couple of weeks.
That just opens up a plethora of questions, right? I mean, I don't know how much you witnessed that you actually want to share, but what can you tell us about that experience?
I think, to be honest with you, my big takeaway from the experience is that this has to stop. That's all I could think of from beginning to end. This has to stop. What you see, or what I saw, is the utmost cruelty that I've never seen in my life, from beginning to end. From even just preparing for the trip, you could tell that the Zionist entity just has an agenda to commit the most cruel acts to prevent people from living. As doctors, we first of all have to be approved by the WHO. And then once we're approved, then we have to start preparing for our trip. And we're only allowed to carry one suitcase and one backpack. We're specifically told not to bring medical supplies. Medical supplies are not allowed for distribution. Diapers are not allowed. Even baby formula is not allowed. And I had the idea, I remember, I'm like, okay, I have to bring in baby formula. Like, have to bring it in. You hear all these appeals for baby formula, especially premature baby formula. And I thought, okay, maybe I could sneak some in. Maybe I could just like pour it into something. I'll say that it's milk because we have to bring all our own food in anyway. So I thought maybe I'll sneak it in. But then I was specifically told, do not do that because they're literally going through your suitcase, looking for formula, throwing it out, looking for bags that look like milk, that that could be formula that you're sneaking in and throw it out. So just think about that for a second. Like what other entity does this? And I mean, I've worked in a lot of different humanitarian contexts in the past. I have never in my life been told you can't bring food for babies who are being starved. So all that to say, I mean, that was just even the big, I hadn't even crossed into Gaza at that point, you know, but I could tell like this is a cruel entity that is bent on causing maximal destruction, starvation, extermination. And honestly, it's disgusting. That's all I can say.
You must have been bracing yourself, right? So you've not been naive to what you were walking into, but then to start to feel it so early in the process. I mean,
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, and it's one of those things that you, like, I mean, all of us, probably everybody who listens to this podcast, I mean, you've got some awareness, but then to be faced with that, like literally you cannot bring food for starving children, starving babies. And another interesting thing I found was just the thought that we're all just tiptoeing around the Zionist entity's policies. Like, I mean, sure, they have these policies. Oh, you can't bring food. You can't do this. You can't do that. There's literally a sign, by the way, at the Allenby crossing that says no medical supplies allowed. Like, there's a sign in red, no medical supplies allowed. But, like, it just makes me think, like, why are we, how is it that they're able to do this? How can they control so much? How can they dictate you can't bring food in? How can they dictate you can't bring medical supplies in? And it's like we're complying with it. I don't even know what to say. Like, how is this even possible?
And you'll still have people out there saying it's not an occupation.
Well, I mean, that's just like, I don't even know how people can say that. Of course it's an occupation. I don't know. I don't know if that's willful ignorance or if that's just trying to hide the truth. I suspect it's just people trying to hide the truth. But it's shocking, isn't it, that they have these rules and we're all following them, you know? And I'll tell you one other thing that's interesting. Like, so when you apply to these organizations, these WHO EMT groups, you know, you have to be approved by the organization that you're applying with. You have to be approved by the WHO. And then, you know, you prepare all your supplies. You fly down to Amman, Jordan. People are going through Amman, Jordan right now because the Rafah border, as you know, has been shut down. In fact, I actually tried to get into Gaza over a year ago, and it was right May 5th when they attacked the Rafah crossing, and it was closed since then, basically. So anyway, so you get everything ready. You fly to Amman, Jordan. The night before, literally the night before you are scheduled to go into Gaza, you can be denied. And so we found out late in the evening, the night before we were leaving, all of us in Amman, Jordan, that, you know, who was approved to go and who was not. And COGAT, who is an arm of Israel, they have the power to say you can go in, you cannot. And at one point a few months ago, the rejection rate was about 50%. I don't know the exact number right now, but it's high. Some organizations have had all of their delegates denied. Some organizations are delisted. In my particular group, there were three doctors. Two of us were approved to go. One of us was not. And there's no rhyme or reason. And the person who got denied entrance was a highly qualified, specialized physician who had been to Gaza before. And a lot of people say, okay, well, maybe we shouldn't speak out against this because if you speak out, you'll be denied entrance. Of course, that's a manipulation. They don't want us to speak out. They don't want us to tell the truth. But the thing is, I don't know if it makes a difference because in this particular case, this was somebody who kept a low profile, you know, didn't have a large social media following and so forth, but still got denied. So it's like, you can decide not to speak out, so you can go back into Gaza, but you could still get denied anyway. Literally, they do whatever they want. And they do it to dissuade you from going. You know, like it's an inconvenience, you know, you get everything ready, you take time off work, you go down, and then you're denied entrance, and then you're like, okay, now what do I do? So that likely would dissuade people from going. So I think that the Zionist entity uses that to to dissuade people, to dissuade organizations. Again, how do they get away with that? How? Just how?
They do a lot to dissuade people from journalists, politicians, you name it. But they fail, right? There are still doctors that will go into Gaza. I mean, like, if you aren't deterred by the situation you know you're walking into, some administrative crap from the Zionist entity isn't going to thwart you. You know, you've got people on the flotilla anticipating what is going to happen to them. That we are just seeing more boats go over. What drove you to need to get into Gaza in the first place? I mean, maybe you can just reflect on it in general as a doctor who goes into conflict zones. This is not, you know, this is not something everyone would do, not even every doctor. So can you talk a little bit about that drive?
Yeah, so I'll start by saying I've previously worked with MSF and the Red Cross, and I've never actually previously gone to Gaza. And one of the reasons why is because I'm a general surgeon. I don't have like a particular, I do have a fellowship in critical care and trauma, but I don't, you know, I'm not a neurosurgeon. I'm not a reconstructive plastic surgeon or anything like that. And although the healthcare system in Gaza has been operating under a siege, there are still exceptional physicians and highly specialized physicians within Gaza who are doing amazing work despite all of the restrictions that the Zionist entity holds over them. So they're doing excellent work. And there wasn't, in the times that I've worked with MSF and the Red Cross, there's never been a time where, you know, me as a general surgeon would be deployed there necessarily. You know, it was typically more specialized surgeons and so forth that would go. Another thing too is like I have always known that like the Zionist entity has so much impunity. You know, they just, you know, I've always been a little bit nervous, to be honest with you, about going into this area. But what drove me recently is the fact that, number one, there was a specific call out for surgeons, particularly general surgeons. And number two, there are very few people who are able to get into Gaza, and it's surgeons. Surgeons, they're calling out for surgeons. And there's a siege on Gaza, and I really felt that I'm a surgeon. I have a duty to try and get in, try and bring supplies in, try and help as best I can, and you know, just be there. So I saw it as a duty. It'd be almost like if, you know, the only person who can save, you know, a child from a building is a podcaster. Like, of course you would go and try and do something. If the only person who could go, who could, you know, get in through a border is X person, like, of course, like, I feel like there truly is a duty.
When you were there, did you feel like, I mean, this is almost a ridiculous question to ask given what we're seeing, but did you?
There are no ridiculous questions.
Did you feel like you were in danger? Because when I heard that you were there, like that sounded terrifying. You know, hearing so many doctors who have been killed in Gaza, and I believe the hospital where you were at had been bombed previously as well. Just what was that like?
Well, I think that the threat to me, you just have to also think about the, like, I was there for a very short period of time. And just imagine how people who are there and have been working in these hospitals for 2 years, how they must feel, you know, living under this every single day, the bombardments. And not only that, is being up all night doing all kinds of complex surgeries on patients. For me, the times that I was nervous were at the borders because I was questioned quite a bit, particularly going in. I did have some supplies with me, so they questioned me a lot. But then later, after I talked to other people, they said, no, that was nothing compared. Some people get questioned for 16 hours. I was just questioned for a much shorter period of time. And I was also a little bit nervous going between the border and our hospital. You know, just we were in an armored vehicle and we were specifically told you cannot film anything. You cannot, you know, take any pictures. And like, I complied with that because I was just nervous. I don't know what right they have to say that we can't take pictures, but, you know, that's what they said. And I kind of listened. So I was a little nervous then. When I was there, there were bombings that you could hear, but there wasn't anything really that close to where we were. I will admit that on the first night, I heard a bomb go off, and I thought it was close. I don't know. Like I've never experienced this before. So I remember I heard something and I actually saw a light too. And I remember we're instructed, okay, make sure you have a safe bag. And, you know, if anything happens, bring it with you. And so what I did was in the middle of the night and I grabbed my safe bag and I went out to the hall and, you know, everyone was just sitting there drinking coffee and smoking and like nobody was fazed by it. And they said, oh yeah, yeah, no, that's far away. Don't worry about it. So
things you never want to get used to.
The whole picture thing really grabbed my attention, and I know that for so many of us we've seen so much on social media, the pictures, but I wanted to get your account if that's okay of like what did you see that they didn't want you to take pictures of on your way to the hospital? What was that scene?
Yeah, so basically the road was almost like sand. When you look from side to side, you see the remnants of buildings, a lot of rubble. And you can see what looks like miles. And it looks like there's miles and miles of this. Rubble, destroyed homes. One interesting thing is that the air is different. I mean, that's not what I saw, but the air is different. The air just feels heavy and thick. You know, it's not like the air of Simcoe County where you breathe in and it's like fresh, clean air. It's very thick air and it's almost like it's almost hard to breathe. It's different. It's not what you're used to or not what I was used to. I will mention that it's not all destruction, though, so I don't want to create the idea that it's only destruction. In between areas, there's flowers. There's like really beautiful, you know, flowers and trees. Sometimes there's kids running around with their bicycles. Sometimes there's families. There's little shops, little tiny, like, you know, people selling various different things, like whether it's water or cookies or, you know, household items. Close to the hospital, there was like a tea shop that somebody opened. And so although there is a lot of destruction, there is also life, a lot of life.
It's not the only thing that's heavy is the air in Gaza. I mean, this is not that we haven't been talking about Palestine, but I think hearing the firsthand account is very, very heavy for me. I want to go back, though, to your duty as a medical professional, because it is a unique position for doctors right now and healthcare workers, because, you know, journalists are not allowed in. When they are there, you know, there's been small examples of our aid planes going over and dropping boxes. And that's even disgusting. Then they're told, don't take photos. So like literally nobody is getting in. And that's why that sign says no medical supplies, is because that's the people using the crossing for the most part. And they also decide who comes out.
Exactly.
The entity. But when you come back, you're still a doctor. How does your role change, though? I mean, it's probably a lot clearer. You're given tasks. You're probably worked to the bone. There's no shortage of patients. You are helping. You're in there. But then you have to leave and you have to come back inside the imperialist beast that is Canada that plays a clear role in this genocide. And your general surgeon skills need to be transferred a little bit, you know, for the cause. They still do good work, right? General surgeons are needed here in Ontario. But how do you do that shift inside yourself and change roles? Like, and how do you take that experience in Gaza and use that energy here?
Well, one interesting thing, and this isn't exactly what you're asking, but there's just a little point I want to address. So one of the things I will mention is the Palestinian healthcare workers that I was working alongside were top notch. Like, they were top notch. And being around people who have that degree of excellence actually motivates me to do better, to like up my game, you know,
like as a surgeon.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. And, you know, I'll just give you one small example. I was doing a case with somebody. It was a resident. The residents are great. And he, at the end of the case, I was like, so what year are you? Are you R4, R5? And he's like, no, I'm R1. R1, that means basically first year resident. He was a first year resident, but he was operating like he was an R4 or R5 resident. And I said, you're R1? And he said, yeah, I've been volunteering for the last 2 years. We've been doing this for 2 years. I mean, every day they would have several cases, you know, like, and they just learn fast and out of necessity. And they've got, you know, like, incredible experience with trauma. I mean, I would rather have no bombing and less experience with trauma, but I mean, they've just got this high degree of excellence. So it's motivated me as a surgeon to, as I mentioned, up my game. But I think you were talking about advocacy more. So what, for me, it's just motivated me further to do what I mentioned earlier, which is to stop this, to do everything I can in my power to stop this. It's really made me think about how it's important to figure out what is most effective, what is most impactful, what is going to directly stop this. You know, I feel like sometimes our activism can feel a little bit performative. It's like we're doing, you know, and I don't want to, like, all act, it's important. I mean, I think that, you know, the tide is shifting, obviously, and, you know, we're protesting and we're writing letters and we're disseminating information on social media. So it's all important. And all of this has been crucial, I think, for shifting the narrative and even putting pressure on our governments. Not that our governments have stopped, but there have been some shifts, I guess. But it's, but yeah, I think we just have to step it up. The same way I have to step up, I want to step up my game as a surgeon. Like, I want to step up my game as a person who is trying to stop this. And I just think that we need to escalate in our efforts. You know, we need to think about how can we have a more direct impact on stopping this genocide and stopping the Zionist entity. And I think that in my mind, it really makes me want to focus on weapons, getting the weapons out of their hands, and also on boycotting, because obviously people are not going to stop. A genocidal entity is not going to stop on its own, but if the Zionist entity crumbles because of economic pressure, then they will, I'm hopeful that the occupation will end, you know. So those are the two things that I've been really thinking a lot about, is how to step up the boycotts and how to directly affect the transfer of weapons.
Well, we've talked to those people. We'll link those episodes where, you know, Arms Embargo Now is doing some great work. World Beyond War folks just tried to shut down a arms convention in London, Ontario yesterday.
Yeah, that was good.
So folks are listening. But you have like a unique experience as like an eyewitness inside Gaza. And a lot of what happens in the media is playing this both sides. Hamas health officials say versus Israel says. I know you won't call it Israel. I was going to ask you about that later, but kudos. I understand where you're coming from there, but you're quite diligent in that. If I did a search F afterwards on the transcript, the Zionist entity will come up many, many, many times. But quite often, despite all we've seen, their word is given equal weight in most media to refute all of the claims coming from Hamas-run health officials or Palestinian journalists or, you know, video proof. What do you do with that role where you are a Westerner who, you know, apparently has more credibility than any Palestinian that lives there, but but in all honesty, you know, we talked to Dr. Yipeng Ji as well and Ben Thompson and just like how they've come back and they're trying to talk to politicians and tell them all of the horrible things that they've seen and, you know, reaffirm the death rate and the targeting of children and the just malicious nature of that entity. To no avail, though. It is just because we've actually all seen it. But do you still feel a responsibility as an eyewitness to document what you've seen in some sort of way?
Yeah, 100%. And I did provide evidence to international courts in regards to what I've seen. So I did keep track of everything that I saw, like every case that I was involved with. And I did provide that evidence. In terms of media, I did contact all of the mainstream media organizations, you know, CBC, CTV, Globe and Mail, Toronto Star, like, and to offer an interview or to give some words. And I haven't heard back from any of them. I will be doing some speaking engagements. In fact, I don't know if I'm allowed to put a plug in for an upcoming speaking engagement. Okay. We're going to, and it's a Simcoe County one. It'll be in Orillia, November 1st. And it's going to be a film screening of 1948, Creation and Catastrophe, which a lot of people see as an unbiased view of what happened in 1948 because there's interviews of people who were on the ground at that time. I don't know if you guys have seen that movie or not.
I haven't seen it yet, so I may drive north to Orillia and join you for that.
Please. Yeah, it would be great to see you. It would be great to see you. And there's also, it's going to be a mutual aid fundraiser for families in Gaza, families that one of our members, Ash, in particular, she's connected with many different families. It's to support them. So, yeah, it would be great to see you there. But anyway, I will be speaking on that day. So that is one way that I'm going to try and help get the word out. I also like to create social media. So I'm creating slides and trying to disseminate that information out based on my experience.
What's the reaction been like from your coworkers and family after you've come back and now you're screaming from the rooftops? Not that you weren't before, but I mean, you probably amped it up.
Yeah. Well, my family was very happy to see me back. They were very worried. They were very worried, but they're all very sympathetic to the cause and they see it. They understand what's going on. And I feel like they're becoming activists themselves. I feel like that's going to happen. I think it's happening. In terms of colleagues, I think it's split. Many people are interested. There are many people who are interested and ask me lots of questions about, you know, what it was like, what I saw. And then they'll go into a rant similar to the rant that I started out with, like, oh, my goodness, design centers are so cruel. They have to be stopped. But then a lot of people, you could split it up into thirds. So maybe about a third of the people really are passionate and really see what's going on and say what I said before, like this has to stop. There's another third who really want to both sides it. And they might be interested a little bit in maybe the medical perspective or the apolitical, neutral, humanitarian perspective, quote unquote. And, oh, it's so sad that there's so much suffering and this has been going on for centuries, that sort of perspective, which is obviously problematic and harmful. And then there's another third who don't even ask and don't seem to want to know, or maybe they think it's too controversial, or I don't know. But, yeah, there's a fair number of people who just don't say anything. So that's basically that in a nutshell.
I've seen you post up about silencing that happens in the healthcare profession. And I think we did touch on it with the doctors I mentioned earlier, but have you experienced that? Like, I'm not going to give that third any kind of cred, but perhaps we can say that that atmosphere feeds into people just being like, you know, not my business. I'm not getting involved. Look what happened to X, Y, and Z when they came back and started talking about their experience and they started calling out the bosses, you know, and for their inaction. Santiago mentioned honest reporting has glommed on to you. So you must be doing something right.
I actually didn't know that. Really? That's like a badge of honor.
You were named for in something honest reporting did.
Oh, good. Okay.
You'll have to send her the link now. She's got to frame it or something, you know, like.
I was actually named by Levithian too, because we renamed St. Vincent Bridge and Barrie Al-Shifa Bridge. And they were mad that, can you believe these people named it Al-Shifa Bridge? Or, I have to say I've been pretty fortunate. I have not been called to the office at work. Nobody has given me a hard time really about what I've been doing or saying. I know that it has been discussed in the sense that when I was speaking to somebody, they said, oh yeah, yeah, what you're doing is fine. We talked about it. You're not on hospital property. You're not representing the hospital. So you can do whatever you want outside of the hospital. So yeah, I've been very fortunate that way. I have not really been silenced too much and I feel comfortable being vocal. And the reality is, like, you know, if there was a serial killer wandering the streets of Barrie, nobody would hesitate about saying, we have to catch the serial killer and stop them. Like, nobody would hesitate about that. And the same way, we have a literal serial killer that is murdering and trying to exterminate Palestinians, trying to erase their existence. Like, we have to call it, we have to call that out and stop them. You know, so I think at this point, if somebody tries to silence me or says anything, like, I'm comfortable enough to say, like, you know, like, I don't care, you know. And I think that, you know, the people who are still trying to justify this, like, they're the ones who should be the pariahs. Do you know what I mean? Like, they should be shamed. Nobody should be shaming me for calling out murder, calling out the Zionist entity for mass murder. Like, other people should be embarrassed for supporting them. And if anybody says to me, like, oh, do you support armed resistance? Of course I support armed resistance. Do you support Palestinian liberation? Of course
I support
Palestinian
liberation. Those should be qualifying questions for all our guests, eh, Santiago?
Yeah, yeah.
Part of the intro.
And you could ask back. It's like, oh, you don't? You don't support Palestinian liberation? Why not? You know what I mean? It has to be like...
Independence is the word they're using now. They support Palestinian independence. Even liberation won't fall off their tongues. Liberals. And even then some. And I mean small L liberals. Like the problematic ones you're talking about where, oh, those poor children, if Hamas would just give up the hostages, why, you know.
Yeah. Can I just say something that I just don't want to forget to say this? Just on the topic of, you know, words that people use and language. And I really feel that the Zionist entity uses terminology like terrorists as a racial slur, essentially. So they can say, we killed terrorists. And that's no different from saying the cockroaches, you know, the genocidal language of other genocides. You know, we killed the cockroaches. We eliminate the whatever racial slur. And they use, I mean, Hamas is the government and the armed wing of Hamas is the, you know, the Qassam brigades. Like, they're freedom fighters. This is a national liberation movement. But yet the word Hamas is used also as a slur. Anything is Hamas, you know, and they use that as justification for murder, you know. And so I think we just have to be conscious of that language, that these are slurs that are used to justify killing. And I'm just going to just reiterate that I'm not saying anyone's a terrorist. Like, I'm saying that armed resistance people are freedom fighters. But I just don't want to make that anyone confused. But like, they're used as a slur by the Zionist entity and by other people and by mainstream media. I will also mention that, in my opinion, the word civilian is problematic too, because people will say, oh, they killed civilians. Okay, so they shouldn't kill civilians. Yeah, of course they shouldn't kill civilians, but they shouldn't kill freedom fighters either. You know, I mean, you know, they shouldn't kill, like, this is not the jungle where you can just kill everybody, you know. Anyway, all that to say, I try and avoid using the word civilian and use the word people instead.
That's a good point. I thought perhaps you were going elsewhere with the civilian comment, because I find and take issue with every Israeli being called a civilian, yet they're settlers.
Oh, they're always called civilian. They're all military,
but
though.
They're also settlers actively expanding using violence in the West Bank.
Exactly.
You know, that's not civilian by definition. They're just lacking a fucking uniform, right? So, or a designation, or maybe pay. Yeah, but even that, I doubt.
They always call Israelis civilians. And they often call Palestinians terrorists. Like, honestly, it's disgusting. It's disgusting. And another thing that they often say is they'll always call Israeli POWs hostages. But they're actually prisoners of war.
Hiding in a tank and kidnap them.
They're prisoners of war. They're not hostages. So I think we need to always check ourselves for when it comes to terminology.
Yeah. Oh, no. Definitely. And language matters, right? It sets the tone and it gives cover to the Zionist entity. I have plenty of examples I've probably shared before. I won't bore the audience there. But I wonder, working alongside Palestinian healthcare workers, what do they say about you coming home? Do they say anything? Like, is it strictly professional? Or, you know, do they look at you at some point and be like, can you make this stop? Like, I don't know. Did you ever talk about ending the occupation or the occupation itself with your Palestinian co-workers?
You know what? To be totally honest with you, at the period of time that I was there, this was pre, like, quote unquote ceasefire. We know that the ceasefire has been violated many times. There was a lot of blast injuries, bombings, violence happening at the time that I was there. And I don't want to make a statement that suggests that everybody thought the same way. So I just want to make sure it's clear that I didn't talk to everybody, you know. I talked to a few people, and not a few people. I talked to several people, but I'm just saying their opinions may not represent everybody's opinion. And I was there for a period of time, and it's a specific period of time. So even the people I talked to, they could have different opinions today or, you know, 6 months ago. But at the time that I was there, the people that I talked to be totally honest, many of them were losing hope. A lot of them were losing hope. And a lot of them would say things like, you know, Gaza's finished and, you know, it's all done. Like, we, you know, and many people were asking for help in terms of navigating moving to Canada, moving to another country. And, you know, I think people wanted to stay in their homeland. They have the right to be there. They're indigenous, you know, they're indigenous Palestinians who have the right to be there and they have the right to return back to their homes in occupied Palestine. But many of them were like, you know, my kids, and they want to survive. People want to survive. So, yeah, honestly, a lot were losing hope. And as I mentioned, a lot wanted to move elsewhere.
That was a gut punch. I mean, I don't want you to sugarcoat it at any, but, you know, damn.
Yeah, and it was really, it's an awful thing to hear, for sure. And I mean, like, there's not a lot you can say to that. You're not going to say, oh, no, like, yeah, everything's going to be fine. Like, you don't...
You can come live with me, you know? Like...
Yeah, and I mean, I sincerely believe the occupation will end. I mean, it has to. What are we doing if it's not? And I think about like Lara Sheehy when she says the precondition is liberation. Do you remember her saying that? Do you listen to her? Yeah, the precondition is liberation. So we have to think that. And even if some people are losing hope, we have to keep pushing. We have to push. Even harder. And honestly, it's our responsibility to stop this because it's our fault. You know, it's our responsibility. We're the people who are providing diplomatic cover to the Zionist entity. We're the people who are sending weapons to the Zionist entity. So it is on us to do more and to stop it. I will mention too, like, I know that I said that, I mean, a lot of people, that I talked to were losing hope. At the same time, things were still happening. People were getting married. People were having babies. People were making plans.
Becoming doctors.
People were becoming doctors. All the medical students showed up for, like, I did a TU. Actually, one of the highlights, honestly, was I did a medical student teaching session just on basic, like, suturing and how to put gloves on, how to put gowns on. And I mean, these medical students were just so smart and they're just so excited. And really, really inspiring. A lot of them were like, my dream is to become a surgeon. Like, and you can see the gleam in their eyes and they're so excited. And one of them said, okay, can I be a surgeon? Do you think I can be a surgeon? You know, they're just so like, they're just, they've got a lot of joy in them. They're so excited to learn. And yeah, there is, people are losing hope, but there's also hope, you know.
I imagine they go through cycles of feelings, right? As the day goes and promises are made and ceasefires come and go. It's got to be an emotional roller coaster. Like, certainly no one here is going to fault anyone for losing hope or trying to find a safe home for their children.
Almost every single healthcare worker that I talked to lost their home. Like, almost everybody lost their home. And people are literally, they're sleeping in tents, no electricity or basic amenities that most of us would be used to. So, you know, they finish their work day and then they have to go home and find water and they have to find food and they have to, like, you know. And then, you know, the first thing a lot of people do when they arrive to work, you could see people looking for chargers so they can charge their devices and everything. And they're working after, like, how often do you, like, if you go, you know, live in a tent overnight and work a hard day at work, like, it's just...
For 2 years, you know.
I don't know, yeah. So, and people work, it's not just any work. It's not just doing, like, a couple, you know, a few cases here, a few cases there. No, people are doing, like, major trauma cases, intense cases, long cases, difficult cases. After sleeping in a tent, it's hard to sleep outside with a lot of noise and, like, and you're worried and you're you know, you're vulnerable to bombardments and come into work all day, no food. A lot of times people, I remember a few times people were like, oh yeah, I haven't eaten all day. Like all day, worked all day, no food, no water, nothing. Like it's just, like it's cruel. It's cruel. What kind of world is this where you have a belligerent pariah state bombing and depriving and forcing people to live like this? And they're just somehow allowed to do it? Like, it's just, like, unbelievable.
The impunity is maddening. We call it the, I know you don't like this word, but Israeli exception, you know. It's,
yeah.
Even the footy fans, I was talking to my husband the other day because this is language he can understand. I'm like, you know, British hooligan fans, their teams, their fans get banned from stadiums all the time. People have to play in an empty stadium all the time. It's just, it's, you know, it happens. But the Tel Aviv fans, like the most racist football club known, you know, their fans are awful. They pretty much destroy Amsterdam and attack Muslims and shout racist chants. And so they're banned from another game and it becomes this global political problem, right? Where the UK PM is stepping in. And I mean, it's just sometimes they seem mundane and silly like that, but it just applies to absolutely everything. It's just there are different rules for this entity than have ever existed for a nation state, even the ones propping them up. You know, we've got to go back to colonial days, right, before international law. But it's being inside Canada and knowing our rule is also very, very, very maddening.
Another example of the double standard, obviously, is in terms of like what gets labeled as like hate speech. You know what I mean? You know, people can say free Palestine and it can get labeled as hate speech. Like there's a woman who has free Palestine on her van. She got in trouble with the police in Orillia for having free Palestine under her van, you know, but yet people who are supporters of the Zionist entity will say all kinds of Islamophobic hate speech and anti-Palestinian racism, and like they'll just get away with it. It's just like, I don't even know what to say.
Free Palestine. Oh, yeah. No, I think we'll have to have you back to talk about what it's like organizing in places like Barrie and Orillia, and for folks outside of Ontario, we can't call them urban. They're tiny little urban centers in the middle of like rural areas, and it's not quite northern Ontario, but it's definitely not Toronto. It's very conservative, usually politically, at least when people go out and vote, it is, and there are groups organizing like Simcoe for Palestine, despite all of that, right? And building momentum and just making sure. It's just, I think, a great example of organizing wherever you are. If there's anything else you want to say about Simcoe for Palestine, Simcoe County for Palestine.
Well, one thing I'll just mention about Simcoe County for Palestine, it's a great group. It's been active for over 2 years now, and I remember when I first started to get involved, like I didn't really see the value of organizing in a smaller city. Like I thought, well, what's the point? I'll just go to Toronto. That was my mentality. But actually, you could have a big impact because the population is smaller. So like proportionally, I guess, you could have a big impact. I was really inspired by a lot of the young people in our group who really were powerhouses and really helped spearhead a lot of things. We do get a lot of detractors. Like, I think that if you go to an event in Toronto, there's a lot more strength in numbers. There's detractors, but you don't get quite as many. I think that in a place like this, all the racists come out and they're very comfortable being racist. We get a lot of people saying, go back to your country. You know, they give you the finger. If you go on, Facebook groups like Barrie Concerned Citizens, like all the racists are out there. Like, I'm sorry to say, you know, there's a lot of hatred and a lot of very, very damaging language and assertions that they make. But I think that it's very important to keep pushing in a place like this. And I have a unique position because I am a doctor. And I think that most people have respect for what a doctor says. Not always. Not that I'm saying that every doctor deserves. But, you know, I think that having that position, there's a privilege that comes with it. And people will usually take you seriously. So, you know, I can just picture a conversation like, you know, sometimes I'll be at an event and maybe have a Palestinian flag or a sign, and you could see a woman like grabbing her kid and taking us away, or like, and, you know, there've been a couple events where we'll have the flag and they'll like give us the finger or say F off or something. And a lot of times they'll have kids in the car. And I mean, you know, I could just picture a conversation like, "Mommy, what was that lady doing? She's a terrorist." "Yeah, but she's a doctor." You know what I mean? And I think it's like, it's important for us as professionals to advocate, to speak the truth, and to widen that Overton window so that, you know, everybody believes that injustice and liberation.
That is a wrap on another episode of Blueprints of Disruption. Thank you for joining us. Also, a very big thank you to the producer of our show, Santiago Helu Quintero. Blueprints of Disruption is an independent production operated cooperatively. You can follow us on Twitter at BP of Disruption. If you'd like to help us continue disrupting the status quo, please share our content. And if you have the means, consider becoming a patron. Not only does our support come from the progressive community, so does our content. So reach out to us and let us know what or who we should be amplifying. So until next time, keep disrupting.